And I feel like, in a sense, it led to an initiation for me, and it's su been such a blessing. So, as we go through the class, it may challenge some of your ideas and concepts, but I'm going to ask that you try to follow it all the way through the end with me, and just see. The other thing that's different for me reads in our circle is, as you know, we usually do a set of Wazifas based on the monthly teaching that we work on together until the next time we meet. Well, this time we're not working with Wazifas. I have selected phrases from this teaching and I've put them at the very end of the document. There's 15 of them. So until we meet again, you can study as many as you want, but I really would like for you to go deeply into these. So just read, one for a few days and then move on to the next one and just see how that can change your mind and your heart space. Shall we say the Sufi invocation now that I've given my disclaimer together? Towards the one. The perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the spirit of guidance. On the website, I put this image, and it's a Rumi's quote, which goes, "Sorrow prepares you for joy. It violently sweeps everything out of your house so that a new joy can find space to enter." And that's kind of the crux of this teaching in some ways. The title is Living Joy, Reconciling Distinctions and Differences. Is there someone that's on not muted? I hear something. Moynihan, you need to be sure you're muted
I
also.
got it. Yeah, no, that was, we're good. Okay.
You good?
Yep.
Okay. You also need there. Here we go. So, as you know, these are inspired by the teachings of Hazrat Inayat Khan, although in this instance, I'm bringing in a few other teachings from other spiritual paths. I pulled two quotes out. One says, "The more elevated the soul, the broader the outlook. The more elevated the soul, the broader the outlook." And Murshid will give an analogy to this later. He says, "Attitude is the principal thing in life. It's not the conditions of life which change life for us, but mostly our attitude towards life and its conditions upon which our happiness and unhappiness depend." Attitude becomes high and broad when we look at things and life from a higher point of view. When our point of view is not high, our range of sight becomes limited. And we know this from our experience, right? When we're on top of a mountain, our view, the vista is quite broad. He says, if we don't look at things from this high point of view, our range of sight becomes limited and we become narrow in our outlook on life, and also in our feelings, our thoughts, our speech. And action, this narrowness is expressed, this limited point of view. Why is God pointed out to on high toward the sky? Why not towards the earth? Because, well, God's everywhere, right? The reason is that within the range of God's sight, the whole universe stands as a little grain of sand. When one flies in a balloon, Murshid said those his words, but we know when we fly in an airplane, we look from high, we can see so far. And when we stand on earth, we have a very limited view. Those of you that are connected with the Native American tradition, we have that saying of little mouse and eagle. Eagle has the big view, soars high. This is the mirror behind me, so if you see this, it's not another person. And Joe's sitting in front of me over there for those that haven't been to the class and seen our environment. At any rate, and Little Mouse just sees right before itself in a very little way. So we have choice. What point of view do we want? a larger point of view or this narrow point of view. He says, when one stands on earth, one sees no further than the four walls which keep the whole world covered from sight. Covered from sight. He poses the question, what does it mean to be spiritual or godly? And he says, it means to have a higher view of life. It is the high point of view in life which ennobles the soul. Ennobles the soul, this aspect of beneficence. He also teaches, we blame others for our sorrows and misfortunes, not perceiving that we ourselves are the creator of our world. This is going to keep going deeper, so just stick with me. Once we know this, we realize this world is our own creation. Murshid says, we may create hideous spirits in our thoughts, and they can become monsters which work against us and will ruin our own life. But if we create the spirit of love and kindness, we will always be surrounded by love and kindness. Has anyone ever done that? Created these thoughts of, you know, like these, well, when we were kids, we did it. You know, there's monsters in the closet, there's monsters under the bed, and we believe it, and it becomes so for us. And in life, we do this too, as adults. But we know full well there aren't any monsters under the bed and there aren't any in the closet, maybe just the closet of our own mind. Once we realize this, our life becomes different. And he says, we become healers. We sympathize with the trouble of another and we serve in the difficulty of another. And some of you I know are in the healthcare profession of one kind or another, and you know this very well from your experience because you're doing it every day. This phrase is very interesting to me, and I'm going to read it a couple times because I think it's full of meaning, and it's a short phrase. He says, a word may help. A word may help. A thought of kindness and sympathy will help. So now we see the difference between the actual word and the thoughts, how it can change the atmosphere. A word may help. A thought of kindness and sympathy will help. I think that's quite profound to contemplate. He says, whatever we do to others, we do to ourselves. Well, this sounds very much like the words, Jesus said it, right? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. Yeah. So that's a teaching that Murshid's drawn upon. And he says, because every thought of kindness or goodness or sympathy has generated a world of sympathy. Even if we go to a land where no one knows us or understands us, we still attract sympathy and love if we have created that within ourselves. I once applied for a sabbatical, and my proposal was to look at adaptability of brands. So in my proposal, I had given this example of the Jolly Green Giant and how we show it on in advertisements and in on, you know, even in the product, how it's branded. But if you go to Korea, it's almost a cartoon-like animation between the Jolly Green Giant and Little Sprout. And if you go to France and you look at it, we see actually these large landscapes of agricultural gardens in the brand. So you can see how a brand like that becomes very adaptable when it can adapt the cultural biases or norms or tendencies. I had made this proposal to go to Italy to look at the Renaissance. I had made it to go to India, birth of spirituality, and of course, to look at America, birth of a nation. And there were the questions about, how are you going to go to these different countries? Do you know those languages? And I said, well, you know, there really is only one language. It's the language of an open heart. And with that, you can get much done. And they accepted that. And I ended up getting the sabbatical to do this study. It was very useful, and we applied it in classes at the college. Merchant goes on to say, thoughts have prepared us for the happiness or unhappiness we experience. Listen to this. The whole of mysticism is founded on this. Thoughts have prepared us for the ha that happiness or unhappiness which we experience. The whole of mysticism is founded on this. If thoughts can accomplish this happiness or happy unhappiness which we experience, so can love and imagination. Even dreams can accomplish it according to the impression which it makes. This is a whole other teaching that Merchant gives us on impressions, which is another class entirely. But these impressions that we carry with us, and I know that you that have studied the message deeply and read the message volumes, you know that Merchant often gives the analogy from his time of a record and how there are lines in the record that make beautiful music. But if there's a scratch on it, so maybe we could say if there's a psychological mark or something that has happened to us, well, we know what happens to the needle, doesn't it? Just skip, skip, skips. And so that's what he's talking about. Thoughts have prepared us for the happiness or unhappiness which we experience. The whole of mysticism is founded on that. And that's the reason we do our practices. It helps to smooth out those scratches, those lines in the mind, in the heart. We know Zikr does that. They say it's polishing the heart, polishing the heart. Breath does it. All the practices help re-script our thoughts and our mind and our perceptions. He goes on to say, thoughts can accomplish this happiness or unhappiness which we experience, so can love and imagination. I just read that. Even a dream, and it's about these again, these impressions on the mind. Some thoughts are like objects. Other thoughts are like beings. Some thoughts are like angels by our side, and some can be like devils. They're thoughts. They're thoughts. Thoughts are all around us, either helping us towards the accomplishment of the objects before us or drawing us back to from those things we wish to accomplish. Thoughts are all around us, either helping us towards the accomplishment of objects. Or drawing us back from those things we wish to accomplish. Now here I'd like to depart with a story. And the story is in Kansas City, where we're originally from. There's a banking family. They're called the Kempers. And they're really a lovely family. They're very committed to community. They don't just take, they give back. And they're very interested in the arts. And I was working on a project in collaboration with a textile designer. And the project had some repute internationally, and they were supporting it. And they had asked us to work on some pieces of clothing from these textiles and also home furnishings things. And they would invite us to their home. And their home was like a castle. I mean, it really was. It's huge. It takes up a whole block in the city. And they'd always say, come in through the back, though, and we'll sit in the kitchen and have cheese sandwiches. And we did, and we'd chat. And the wife shared with us that she was a Christian Science and her husband, an Episcopalian. And before they got married, they agreed. Because if you know about Christian Science, you know that the healing is, again, prayer and looking at our thoughts and sort of what we're thinking is what we become. This is true in many ways. Even science teaches us this to some extent. Well, anyway, she conveys this story to us. And they would go on these skiing trips. And one of the children, it happened to be a female. From the very top of the ski lift, there was something with, I've not been skiing, but it sounded like there was something didn't latch properly, and as it moved, she fell to the ground. It didn't kill her, but it crushed like her bones inside. So they told them she's going to be in a body cast for at least 18 months. And then after that, she may have to have various braces and structures. She'll probably have to learn to walk again. We don't know. We can't even promise that. I mean, it was a very dire situation. This is a true story, honest to goodness. So Bibi said she had the whole community, and she had a brick breach, you know, she had a, you know, the family. So they had all these people praying. And she had this feeling that after 6 weeks, the girl was probably well. And of course, the doctors were like looking at her like, we don't think so. But because of the money they had a friend that could get an x-ray. They said, we don't care what it costs. We want you to go ahead and x-ray through the cast. In 6 weeks, that girl was healed. That's what thoughts and prayers can do. That's what thoughts and prayers can do. Now, I'm not saying that if someone's ill or has had an injury, we've all had people in our lives that are, you know, paraplegics or quadriplegics, they function in a very beautiful way, and there's something to be taught by that. I'm also not talking about people that might have some form of mental illness. That is an illness like everything else. So there's no fault if someone's haunted by their thoughts, but we would suggest, of course, therapy for that, possibly medicine. But this is the mystical path that we're talking about here. And I wanted to share that story because it was quite unbelievable. But the girl went on to live a normal life. She was not in a wheelchair. She did not walk with canes, braces, a walker, or anything. So that's a miracle. And it's a very beautiful story to recall, I think, that these things are possible. We also have people that live, you've all heard of H&R Block, right? The tax people. Well, they are from Kansas City also. And one of the brothers, they're Henry and Richard Block. That's how it got to be H&R. My mom tells the story when she was in college, she worked during the summers downtown and would take the bus up Main Street. And she said they were so small then, it was just the two brothers. They had one desk and they had two chairs on each side of the desk and a little green lamp that hung between them. And they'd be working late into the night, especially during tax season. And one of the brothers got cancer and it was very dire also. It's like you need to get all your affairs in order. This is a very bad prognosis. And he was like not ready to die. And guess what? He lived 19 more years and died of a heart attack, not cancer. So we never really know. But he was determined to live. He was determined that there was a lot of life still. He had a lot of things to accomplish. And therefore, he did. We know that about Golda Meir as well. She was given 6 months and she went on to live and continue to be prime minister. So these are the way our thoughts form our lives and our future. Again, I want to say to be ill and to die isn't the worst thing that can happen. We always say Sufis die before death, and we look forward to that everlasting life with the beloved. So I just kind of want to clarify that. Just sort of take this as it's given. So Murshid goes on to say, first, one must be, know what we need. Now he's talking about thoughts are all around us. They can help us accomplish what we wish, or they can hold us back. They can be self-limiting. And he says, first, one must know what we need and become the master of ourselves and our thoughts and our life. Then our personality will be more agreeable and pleasant, and we will become a blessing to all we meet in the world. Well, who doesn't want to do that? I mean, the world needs to be uplifted. And there's enough going on now that we need to be those lights. We need to be those lights for others. He says, we learn to understand that there's a world in oneself, that in our mind there is a source of happiness and unhappiness. He just keeps saying it again and again. He also says, the source of health and illness, the source of light and darkness, and that it can be awakened either mechanically or it will. I'll speak more about the mechanically. He goes on to say, then we do not blame our ill will, nor do we complain to others about our misfortune. We become more tolerant, more joyful, and more loving towards our neighbor because we know that every thought and action And if we see it all as an effect of a certain cause. So I turned to another part of the message, and this is from Awakening of the Soul in Sufi Message Volume 14. And Murshid says, the bringers of joy are children of sorrow. It's like the message that Rumi gives us. Sorrow cleans out our house so that joy is welcomed in. The bringers of joy are the children of sorrow. How can that be? I mean, you have to ask yourself, what does he mean by that? Think about it. He says, every blow we get in life pierces the heart and awakens our feelings to sympathize with others. Every living being has a time of awakening to every season, there is a turning. To some people, it comes in a moment's time by a blow, by a disappointment, or because their hearts has been broken through something that happened suddenly. So we might call that maybe a mechanical sudden awakening. We can't avoid it. We may try, but it would take a lot of energy to avoid disappointment or heartbreak in our lives. I know that people try to do that, but when they realize what they've done, they get a great release when they just get in the flow and let life be. It seemed cruel, but at the same time, the result is a sudden awakening. In the other parts of the message volume, he talks about how an illness can do this, or an accident can do this. The outlook is changed, the insight deepened, joy, quiet, independence, and freedom were felt, and compassion showed in the attitude. A person would never for, who would never forgive, who likes revenge, or who was easily displeased and cross, a person who would measure and weigh when their soul is awakened, they become like a different person. That's why we receive great blows in life. I think that's another key line. Instead of feeling sorry for ourselves for the misfortune or mishaps or disappointments, he says that's why we receive great blows in life. The person becomes more thoughtful as soon as the fire appears and looks at things differently. But if life's changes and great blows, the wise realize that joy, rest, and peace come. Kind of like, well, now that that's happened, I think I can kind of handle most anything that happens. Somehow strengthens us, but it does. God is great, and I do believe it makes us more compassionate and more loving when we go through those hardships ourselves and we have sympathy. And you know what the big lesson is? We look. If we didn't have those experiences, we would never learn about things like forgiveness. How do we learn them otherwise? What a great gift we receive from God. The purpose of our life is to, our, the purpose of our life on earth is to look at all the distinctions and differences without being overwhelmed by them. So he's not saying, oh, you know, everything's rainbow and unicorns, and just think happy thoughts and it's all going to be okay. That's not it. The purpose of life, I see you smiling, Maria Rahima, you get it. The purpose of life on earth is to look at all the distinctions and differences without being overwhelmed by them. We should go rising on rising and rising above them all, raises about the distinctions and differences which divide. And at the same time, experiencing them all. You know, I don't know. I'm not in big Sufi circles anymore, but I know at one point everybody was saying, don't do the spiritual bypass. Don't do the spiritual bypass. You know, and it's like, you know, practices aren't drugs. You know, it's not to lull us back to sleep. It's to waken us up. And I think that's true. And Mershad is saying this here. The purpose is to see the distinctions and differences without being overwhelmed by them. We should go on rising above them and at the same time experiencing them all. The one who has received all the good that has come to them with grateful thanks and who has felt it and at the same time has felt the harm done to them and has forgiven and pardoned it all. Such a person is the one who has seen the world and will go beyond it. I think that's really powerful. It changes things if we think about it. Well, some of you know that in the Mahayana tradition, they have something called Lojong slogans. I don't know, I think there's 100, maybe there's 108. We used to have little cards. I don't know what happened to them in our move. I have to find them because we would just change them for a few days and read them. And then kind of, they were on a little like art stand and they were little cards that we would change. So he said, and these Lojong sayings are designed as a set of antidotes to undesired mental habits that cause us suffering. So these habitual thoughts. Well, there's one slogan, and it states, drive all blames into oneself. That's a hard one. Drive all blames into oneself. Someone did that, but I'm to blame. How is that? Well, it's not advocating martyrdom. It implies that the pain comes from holding so tightly to having things our own way and wanting the world to conform to our view, that that's the blame we drive into oneself. When we find ourselves in this place, we have the tendency to blame others for our feelings and our disquieted minds and our hurts and our disappointments. It's their fault. Is it, or are we allowing ourselves to feel that way? And believe me, I know. I've given that talk before of how all the disappointments of life have actually, if I would just wait and see, have turned into these great, great, what do you say, obstacles that made me stronger. And you all know that too. You've had it, I'm sure. So this slogan is helpful and an interesting suggestion that we can begin to shift these deep-seated habits, these tendencies of having everything on our own terms. This slogan helps us to be mindful of this tendency, drive all blame into oneself. So when we have the tendency to blame something outside ourselves, we can try to get in touch with that. And it feels that when we're feeling like we're hanging on to that view so tightly, that creates an action to blame. Drive all blame into oneself. In this way, we realize we ourselves are to blame for our discomfort. It's a choice, right? You've heard that before. It's a choice. Be happy. We can loosen the bounds of our limited view through this. So those Lojong sayings, if you haven't studied them, you might want to look them up. They're very helpful. And you know, there's so much of Buddhism about training the mind, first taming the mind, then training the mind. Mershad says, it is the understanding of things from every point of view that enlightens us, a point of view which neither refuses to believe nor believes in a blind way. I remember when I was just entering Sufism, I was very touched by that phrase of Mershad's that says, defined a Sufi as a person that can look at things from their own point of view and the point of view of another. And I remember Mershad Wali Ali had come to Kansas City and he asked that question, what does it mean to be a Sufi? And I waited because I was very new and I thought, somebody knows the answer, surely. And no one answered. And I said, well, and I gave that answer, looking at things from one's own point of view and the point of view of another. And he said, yeah, that's it. And I was so glad that it had gone deeply into me that I had taken that in. I mean, I have to remind myself of it sometimes, but it's good to remind myself and practice it. So cannot our own mind and also our situation in life be turned from heaven to hell and hell to heaven? This is where the difference between the two, well, we see the difference. We see things this or that. The Buddhists would say this and that. And Murshid says, this is where we see the difference between the two. And at the same time, their oneness. But these are just flows of energy, you might say. In the Vajrayana tradition, that's what we're talking about. This sort of tantric understanding of energy and being able to shift it. Have you noticed that throughout this teaching, Murshid is highlighting a series of koans? It's like, wait, wait, what did he just say? It goes back and forth. A koan is, of course, a paradoxical antidote or a riddle that confuses the logical mind, and it can provoke a moment of enlightenment or an aha. So that's what he's doing. He's kind of saying these things in a certain way that made me think, what? Wait a minute. What did he just say? Did I hear that right? You did. I'm trying to be as true to his words as you can. He says to us this, what I think is a beautiful thing to recall. He says, as people of different races, nations, and religions each have their own standards of right and wrong, their own conception of good and evil, and their own ideas about sin and virtue, it's difficult to discern the law of governing these opposites. So here's a few examples. If you go into a church, in a church, I'm saying, so Christian church, men would not wear hats. Come on, it's disrespectful, so they take their hats off. But if you go into a mosque or you go into a synagogue, you always wear something covering the crown of your head. Okay, there's a difference. But if we didn't know that, we might judge someone. Well, I know all of you are so well traveled and experienced, you know this. But that's an example. Likewise, we wouldn't take our shoes off to go into a church, but we would to go into a temple or a mosque. So these are different standards of right or wrong. You know, the Indians in their plays, you might see, you may even see nudity because it would express something. They don't consider that vulgar, and you wouldn't see it sexually, but you might see an exposure to body parts where they consider violence. That is never seen in a play. It's always implied off screen. Maybe through sound or something, because they consider violence as vulgar. So there's another difference of standards. Colors the same way. If you were designing something for an Islamic country, you wouldn't casually use the color green because it represents Islam. So these are many things that are different about things. A woman in India wears red. Who would think of that in America? So these are different standards, and we might judge them as right or wrong or good and evil. You know, I mean, my God, Kali, she looks so fierce. You know, she's got the skulls around her neck, the blood coming from her mouth. We don't understand it. We think it's a demon. But she has a great, beautiful meaning behind all that. So looking at things from one's point of view and that of the other. Murshid says, the idea of opposites, distinctions, and differences keep us in illusion. We're going back and forth and back and forth, like those balls with the paddle. You know? Seeing this to be the nature and character of life, the Sufi says that it's not so important to distinguish between two opposites. What's more important is to recognize the one, capital O, that is hidden behind it all. Naturally, when we come to this realization, the Sufi climbs the ladder which leads to unity. Unity. There's such great power in unity, uniting our hearts, uniting our minds. To the idea of unity, which comes through the synthesis of life by seeing the one in all things and in all beings. So, again, not away from life, in life, participating in life, experiencing life. When a person awakes to the spirit of unity and sees the oneness behind all things, then their viewpoint becomes different and their attitude changes. There was someone that I was very good friends with. I won't mention his name here because somebody might know him, but he was a very good teacher in a very subtle way. And his students would often come and talk to me because they'd say, we're trying to explain this thing to him, because there were all these frictions in between them. And he never responded to it. He'd just kind of smile and nod. He'd listen to everyone very patiently. But his whole deal, and he lived it, and he was fully in life, was unity. And so he was very calm. He was very impatient. He didn't take sides. He didn't even advise. But in that, he gave them the courage to try to work it out themselves. It was a good lesson, very good lesson to observe. I appreciate that very much. When a person awakens to the spirit of unity and sees the one behind all things, then their point of view becomes different and their attitude changes. They're no longer judging, they're observing, and they understand it all as part of that unity. But our sight is very limited, and our conception of right and wrong and good and evil is only our own and not according to God's plan. It is true that if we see it as such, it is such for us. But when it comes to God, the whole dimension is changed and the whole point of view is changed. How could we ever learn such things as forgiveness and forbearance if we weren't challenged in life situations? There'd be no possible way. It's part of God's good plan to bring these things upon us. Likewise, illness. I understand that very well from my own experiences and from experiences of family members, what that can teach us. What kind of strength and wisdom can come from it, and what a good example one can become. I know, Krishna, by you've gone through your challenges and you've resurrected from them, and you're a good example for us. I'm glad you're here. Another important point. It's a great pity if a person does right or good because they want to progress or become spiritual. For what is good after all? It's a very small price to pay for spirituality. And the person who depends on their own goodness to attain spirituality may just as well wait 1,000 years. For it is just like a person who's collecting all the sand they can to build a hill to climb up to heaven. Futile. If you know the stories of Marpa and Milarepa, am I right, Joe? Build the temple, tear it down, build the temple, tear it down. Same. It's a good story. If you don't know it, look it up. It is a very small price to pay for spirituality, and the person who depends on their goodness to attain spirituality may just as well wait 1,000 years. For it's just like a person collecting all the sand they can to make a hill so that they can climb to heaven. If one is not good for the love of good, if one does not do right for the love of justice, but instead for one's own satisfaction, there's no meaning in doing right. There's no virtue in doing good. To be spiritual is to become nothing. To be good is to become something. And to be something is like being nothing. Here's these koans. While nothing is like being all things. So that's a little bit of one to study again. Shall I read it again? Yeah, okay. If one cannot do good for the love of good, if one does not do right for one's love of justice, but instead for one's own satisfaction, then there's no meaning in doing right. There's no virtue in doing good. To be spiritual is to become nothing. To become good is to become something. Again, that's a limiting thought, but he's talking about this self-effacement, this dying before death. Okay, so to become spiritual is to become nothing. To become good is to become something. It is, it, and to be something is like being nothing. In a whole different way, nothing. It's like we can throw all that nothingness away, while to be nothing is to be like all things. The claim to spirituality hinders the natural perfection. Self-effacement is the return to the Garden of Eden. So, funny story. Hadid and Aziza come. They're visiting us. He's going to be participating with David Barg, giving this concert of his music. David Barg asked to give his this concert of La Monotonia at the Suzuki School of Training, which was taking place not far from our home, about an hour away. But they stayed, and every day if we'd drive, and we'd have these wonderful talks. Kind of like my dinner with Andre. I remember he had asked me a question. It was when they first arrived, and they were sitting, he was sitting in the living room, and he asked me a question, and I answered him in a very forceful voice. And he said, "Thank God I can hear you." He said, "I don't understand why when people are trying to be spiritual, they talk in a soft voice. You can't hear a thing they say." It's like, don't pretend, be who you are. And Aziza was like, stop. Well, there's an article that I think I wrote about it recently, which she's saying, stop pretending to be spiritual, just be natural. They liked the people were natural, and they were natural in their own way. Not everyone understood, but they were very much so. So, to claim to spirituality hinders the natural perfection. Self-effacement is to return to the Garden of Eden. And I have to say, I myself was very soft-spoken when I first started teaching. And Mrshida Vira came, she was coming to my classes at the Ozark camp, and she'd say, "Nuria," and she had a strong voice, even in her old age, "I can't hear you." And I'd say, "Oh, Mrshida, would you like to come sit near to me?" And she said, "No, you need to learn to project your voice so everyone can hear you." And Hadayah did. He never used a microphone, even in his 90s. He had a very powerful voice, but he was also a master of the breath. Okay. What does it mean to become spiritual or godly? It means to have a higher view of life. She keeps talking about this. Broaden our outlook, to look at life from a high point of view. He says it twice in this one sentence. It is the high, now it comes again. It is the high point of view which ennobles the soul. It is by a broad outlook on life that spiritual aristocracy is realized. I have a couple more things, and then I'm going to close with a quote by Mershon. I was very touched. When they said after the passing of Pope Francis that he was calling upon Catholics to be missionaries of peace and mercy. And I thought, why can't we all be missionaries of peace and mercy? I mean, after all, those are the first words in the whole Holy Quran, right? Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So calling upon people of faith to be missions of, missionaries of mercy, that just struck me so much. We don't have to be a cleric or a priest or a minister or anything. We can do that in everyday life. And Murshid gave us these words. These are our touchstones and our stepping stones on the path. And the words we know, love, harmony, and beauty. And if we think, speak, and act with these as our measure, we can create heaven on earth. Now, I want to share another thing from another Buddhist perspective, because somehow it has all come together in this way for me. You probably all know this, but I'd like to share it with you. It's called the Third Patriarch of Zen. It's from the Third Patriarch of Zen, whose his name was Seng Tsang. It's in Chinese, it's called Xin Xing Ming, but the English of that means inscription on faith in the mind. So again, training the mind, our thoughts, Mercer has said again and again throughout, our thoughts, our thoughts, our thoughts. So this reads like this, and it's so beautiful. I mean, this could be a daily study. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preference. When love and hate are both absent, then everything becomes clear and undisguised. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. No preferences. I can see it this way and I can see it that way. Now, maybe we have to have discerning wisdom to move forward. I'm not saying not to. Second stanza. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven earth is set infinitely apart. So this is, again, I'm going to go back. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what we like against what we dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. The great way is perfect, like vast space, where nothing is lacking and nothing in excess. Indeed, it is due to our choosing to accept or reject that we do not see the true nature of things. Live neither in the entanglements of outer things nor in inner feelings of emptiness. Be serene in the oneness of things, and such erroneous views will disappear by themselves. And so, in some ways, this third patriarch of Zen, the inscription on faith on the mind, is so much to me, in a very encapsulated way, saying what Murshid said, or I used Murshid's words to say it again and again. So just these other thoughts. This is like one parting thought from Murshid, and all the resources where I've extracted these excerpts are at the bottom of our study guide. But he says this: never for one moment think, as many do, that a spiritual person means being sorrowful, dried up, or a long-faced person. You know how sometimes you see people that are spiritual and they're so serious, I guess. It just seems they're so serious. Yes, life is profound and, it can be tough, but never for one moment think, as many do, that a spiritual person means to be sorrowful, dried up, or long-faced. Spirit is joy. Spirit is life. And when that spirit has awakened, all the joy and pleasure that exist are there. As the sun takes away all darkness, so spiritual light removes all worries, anxieties, and doubts. Spiritual light removes all worries, anxieties, and doubts. I remember Wally Ollie also during that same visit to Kansas City gave us a practice, and he said, look into kind of your heart space and look at something that's troubling you or challenging you, and now breathe light into it. And don't search for an answer, just see if one naturally arises. It was a good practice. I go to that from time to time because it's very helpful to illuminate things and to try to look at things from different points of view. If a spiritual awakening were not so precious, then what would it be of use seeking it in life? It is a treasure that no one can take away from us, a light that will always shine and will never be extinguished. That is spiritual awakening. And this is the fulfillment of the purpose of life. So it's always very important to me, and my teachers would, especially my Tibetan Buddhist teachers would say, you must always save the merit and dedicate it, because they'd say to me, you know, it's like on the computer. You know, if you don't save your files from time to time, they can easily be lost if you have a glitch in the electricity. And they said, one moment of anger or distraction can do the same to the merit that you've created. So before we get in any discourse, let's do this and just say, if there's anything of merit that's been created, may it benefit all beings. Can we close with the Ketuvim? O thou who art the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the Lord of heaven and earth, open our hearts that we may hear thy voice, which constantly cometh from within. Disclose to us thy divine light, which is hidden in our souls, that we may know and understand life better. Most merciful and compassionate God, give us thy great goodness. Teach us thy loving forgiveness. Raise us above the distinctions and differences which divide us, and send us the peace of thy divine spirit, and unite us all in thy perfect being. Amen.